You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We now bring you Salvationist from the Jews with Roy Shulman.
Hi, this is Roy Shulman, and welcome once again to Salvation is from the Jews, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic faith, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the completion, the fulfillment, the full realization of all of the promise and potential of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. Now today, once again, I have the great pleasure and privilege to have on the show a guest who I've invited on to talk about a most extraordinary Catholic personage of the 20th century, who also had a lot to do, in fact, with the conversion of the Jews, who is Dietrich von Hildebrand. There are two dimensions of the story that I think will be of great interest today. One is Dietrich von Hildebrand and his love for the Jewish roots of Catholicism, his love and close friendship with a number of Jews, and the extraordinary number of Jews who he influenced to see the truth of who Jesus was and the truth of the Catholic Church, and invited them into the Catholic Church. My understanding, and our guest may correct me on this, is that Dietrich von Hildebrand and his wife, Alice von Hildebrand, between them, brought over 100 Jews into the Catholic Church. And the other interesting aspect of the story that has a lot to do with the nexus between Judaism and the Catholic Church is that Dietrich von Hildebrand, during the Holocaust, during World War II, was one of the most outspoken Catholic critics of Hitler and Nazism. In fact, I believe he was named a kind of public enemy number one of the Third Reich for his activism against Hitler and what he was doing. But in so doing, and in so doing as a very prominent Catholic figure, he ran afoul of some other elements in the Catholic Church who were far more sympathetic to Nazism and National Socialism. And so he's also a very interesting figure from that perspective. So with that brief introduction, I'd like to invite on our guest, John Henry. Are you there?
I am here. Thanks for having me, Roy.
It's a pleasure. We've been friends for a number of years. As a matter of fact, on a personal note, John Henry's father is the godfather of my wife. So I suppose in a way we're a funny kind of god-in-law or something.
I think so.
So anyway, I guess I was remiss in mentioning John Henry's specific connection with this topic is manifold, but one is that he began a very successful project to bring Dietrich von Hildebrand's writings into fuller light today, the Dietrich von Hildebrand Project, which he may speak briefly about. And the other is that that initiative of his brought into print Dietrich von Hildebrand's wartime memoirs entitled My Battle Against Hitler, from which we will be speaking today. So with only two introductions, John Henry, why don't you, take us from here?
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Roy. Well, again, I'm delighted to be here, and I think the points of contact are so great that we are definitely in some kind of broad family relationship here, and I'm just so happy to be here. So, yes, just a word, a very generous introduction of you here, and indeed the most recent publication, namely the book My Battle Against Hitler, Faith, Truth, and Defiance in the Shadow of the Third Reich, which contains Dietrich von Hildebrand's memoirs and anti-Nazi essays, and we'll talk more about what that exactly is maybe the most immediate reason that I'm here, as this book has just come out less than a year ago and has done a great deal to bring von Hildebrand back into the public eye. And perhaps that's a good starting point just to say a few words about who he was, because for many, many people, the name, particularly for Catholics, the name Dietrich von Hildebrand is a great and important name. Many people particularly of a generation or two back, associate him with having been a critical voice, in the church, a critical voice for Catholic orthodoxy in the 50s and 60s. An author of much beloved books. Perhaps his most famous book is a book called Transformation in Christ, which is an enormously significant work written by him as a layman and not really as a as a theologian. He was trained as a philosopher, and this work of meditation on the Christian life shaped a generation of Catholics. But what few people knew about, except in very slim detail, was the story of Dietrich von Hildebrand as the great enemy of Nazism, the great enemy of German National Socialism, and also of communism, and an enmity that was not just one that began and ended in the classroom, but one that was taken into the public square. Von Hildebrand, as a philosopher, going into public confrontation with the Nazis, founding a newspaper, leading the intellectual resistance in Austria, all of that, this story is only now really coming to light. And so that, by way of a brief teaser, I can say more perhaps before we dig into that more. Roy, what do you think about just a few observations just about his early life and something to help our listeners dive in? Is that what you would like for me next?
Yeah, I think that a few minutes on just a rough outline of who this extraordinary personality was, and then we can get into the specifics.
Very, very good. All right. So perhaps one way of looking at it is to say, do we see any foreshadowing of this enemy number one of the Nazis in the early life of von Hildebrand? And in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. So let me just take the readers back briefly to where he began. So von Hildebrand was born into a prominent German family. His father was a famous sculptor and architect, widely known and much loved by the Germans, a kind of national treasure for the Germans. He had done significant sculpture of public monuments in Munich, and so this was very much a leading cultural family to be born into. Von Hildebrand was the last and only the only son and last child. He had five elder sisters in this family, and he was born in Florence because the father, as perhaps all good painters and sculptors do, decided that the place to be was in Italy. And so the family lived in a converted monastery, a beautiful converted monastery just outside of the center of Florence. And so young von Hildebrand grew up actually speaking German in the family, but also Italian as one of his mother tongues, and was deeply shaped by his upbringing there. What many people don't know about him is that he was not raised as a Catholic and not really even raised as a Christian. The family was nominally Christian, but in the vaguest sense of the term, they were, I mean, one can discuss, but, you know, the different influences, but essentially it was a kind of nominal Protestantism at best, not taken seriously. The family religion was really a religion of beauty and of high culture. One can get the wrong idea, though, and imagine that this was a place that was hostile to faith. And one thing that comes out from von Hildebrand's memoirs is that while there was a fundamental incompletion and a fundamental lack of sort of breaking through to spiritual reality, the family cultivated something very significant, and that was reverence, kind of reverence before natural mystery. So nature was perceived with awe. The sexual sphere was perceived with a kind of awe. Alice von Hildebrand tells me that his parents would never have thought of contracepting, which is a remarkable point when you consider the reasons for it. And then there was this enormous awe for the beautiful. And of course, then for artistic geniuses, they were the kind of saints of the family. And this down the line would play an important role in von Hildebrand because it shaped him so deeply that in years to come, it played an essential role in his conversion to Catholicism. But let's put that on pause. So we have his upbringing there. Now, during his early youth, he discovers philosophy. And this is not philosophy primarily as in the classroom or the philosophy of the scholar. This is philosophy understood in the ancient Platonic way. This is philosophy as a way of life, truth for living. And as a young boy, he began to read the dialogues of Plato. And the character of Socrates made an enormous impression on young von Hildebrand, particularly this uncompromising quest for truth. What is the truth of the matter? That made an enormous impression on von Hildebrand, and also the Socrates' willingness even to give his life ultimately for the truth was enormously impressive for Hildebrand, and that set him on his course. He realized in reading these dialogues of Plato that he had found his vocation. He wanted to study philosophy when he went into university. So he goes on to study philosophy, turns out to be a prodigious talent, studies with some of the leading minds in Germany at the time. And then he, during his time in philosophy, he meets a man named Max Scheler. And Max Scheler, who coincidentally was also a great influence on the later Pope John Paul II, was a brilliant Catholic mind with a troubled relationship to the faith, ultimately died outside of the faith, but at the time was a rather ardent Catholic, and spoke ardently about the faith to young von Hildebrand.
And let me interrupt
you for a moment. Sure.
You just said something like coincidentally was Max Scheler was also a major influence on Pope John Paul II. And it's a little not entirely coincidentally, right, because it just occurred to me our listeners are probably not aware that Dietrich von Hildebrand had a huge influence on John Paul II, and they reflect a very parallel stream of personalism in Catholic philosophy.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. I was sort of self-censoring against going too deep into all of these themes, but you're the boss, so you absolutely it's actually far more than coincidental. It's a very very fundamental to understanding the history of the major intellectual streams at the time, and particularly the influence on John Paul. I mean, there's a lot that one can't entirely imagine John Paul having done without the influence of figures like von Hildebrand and Scheler going before him. So, in any case, Scheler makes this very, very striking claim in a conversation with the young von Hildebrand. He says, the Catholic Church is the true church. And for von Hildebrand, that was a claim that was difficult to process in a way because churches weren't true or false. They were sort of different. They were cultural realities. They were primarily the sources of artistic inspiration. They played an important role in history. They'd had a political function. But this idea that a church would be true and that perhaps other churches and other religious claims to truth were not equally true, that was striking to him. And here we go back to the theme of beauty. Scheler then said to von Hildebrand, and the reason the evidence of the Catholic Church's truth claims lies in the fact that she produces saints. And he then wrote a beautiful and memorable passage in a book of his, which is on other themes, in fact, but the passage that he wrote very much for his friend Dietrich von Hildebrand was a kind of sketch of St. Francis of Assisi. And it was a sketch that really went after this phenomenon of sanctity. What is the difference between sanctity and natural goodness? And for von Hildebrand, this was very fundamental because in Scheler's claim, not only did he encounter in a very significant way the beauty of sanctity, but also the irreducible reality of grace to nature. In other words, grace really is this realm of being, and it's not just somehow a way that we describe very good people or very holy people. And in fact, von Hildebrand, who then converted in 1914 at the beginning of the war, just before the war, in the months before, he wouldn't write much of anything for many years. In fact, he took this time to immerse himself in his reading of Catholic history of the fathers. He spent a great deal of time reading in the work of St. Augustine. And when he finally wrote, you might say, his first major piece as a Catholic, it was an essay called The New World of Christendom. And the essay is essentially a meditation on grace and the tangibility and even the ability to experience grace as a reality that just can't be derived from purely human or natural sources. So for von Hildebrand, it was, you might say, the reality of grace, the beauty of grace, and then the beauty of Christ as the source and summit of God's grace in the world. That, above all, captivated him and became the lifelong nourishing source for his faith ever after. And it's very interesting because if you think about other famous converts, if you think about C.S. Lewis or if you think about John Henry Newman, you have, of course, different aspects, personal aspects, of course, experiential things that happened in their lives. But you have, in some sense, something more intellectual. In Newman, you have a kind of reading of himself into the Catholic Church. In C.S. Lewis, you have many literary influences. But in von Hildebrand, it began, really, with this experience. He was somehow opened up or freed to experience the beauty of the saints, the beauty of Christ. And then this was so convincing for him that it brought him into the church and then led to a kind of post facto, you might say, immersion into the church's teaching and tradition that then allowed him to become, of course, a very, very powerful and effective defender in the years to come.
Let me, again, just interject something that comes to mind as you speak, which is I'm reminded of both Edith Stein and Alphonse Ratisbonne, two Jewish converts to the Catholic faith, both of whom said at different points in time, essentially, that if anyone is seeking truth fully enough and wholeheartedly enough, they will be led to the truth of the Catholic Church. So that's another dimension, right? That Dietrich von Hildebrand was absolutely uncompromising in caring about truth.
Yes, yes. No, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, one has to ask whether, I mean, that beautiful statement of Ratisbon seems to there seems to be evidence for it in the life of von Hildebrand, because there was this wholehearted readiness to receive truth and live by it. And the beautiful line of St. Augustine that is momentarily escaping me in its exact quotation, but in the Confessions, where he says that the inner marrow of his soul was yearning for truth. I mean, this could have been von Hildebrand's slogan, because he caught, you might say, an appetite for it, not just again as a matter of intellectual interest, but as something that was the North Star of his life. So in any case, he became about as ardent a Catholic as you can imagine. And there's a rather humorous story that his wife Alice, his widow Alice, tells today, that he became so enthusiastic in the years after his conversion that he became almost a bother, because he couldn't not talk about his newfound faith. And in fact, his confessor then said to him, for Lent, you should give up talking about your conversion, because you're driving people away. You're making yourself impossible. But that was how he responded to what he'd received. He just couldn't sit on it. And then to the point about bringing people into the church, both Jews and non-Jews, this, I think you see the seeds of it. He had this, as a personality, he was effusive and he was very much a sanguine, in certain respects, but as a Christian and particularly in the way in which he was a philosopher, it was so much, again, a matter of searching for something, the pearl of great price, and then upon finding it, wanting to share it with anyone who would listen. And that became, you might say, the basic mode in which he would operate throughout his life. And so even when he wasn't, you might say, outright in evangelization mode, even when he was simply living his faith, it had, by all accounts, those who met him along the way, it had an enormous impact, because it was a fresh, unconstrained kind of Christianity. It was not, you might say, kind of chastened by social concerns or by sort of the need to appear measured. I mean, he had given his heart to it, and he showed the world what he had received.
Great.
So that takes us. I don't know whether if you'd like to make any observations, but that takes us, you might say, to the time of his conversion. It takes us to about 1914. We can move a little bit forward here and basically get him up to the point where he becomes the Nazi antagonist that he became.
Why don't we just kind of fast forward to the rise of National Socialism in Germany and Hitler's election, or it actually was election.
That's the terrifying reality, yes, right.
That's the terrifying reality, but, as an American in 2014 or 15, I can't throw stones.
No, I mean, it's true, and we have yet to see what our future holds, but it's most of us think, I think the kind of popular narrative is that as a dictator, of course, he would have staged a coup or used terror to instate himself, and while those are definitely features of Hitler's rise to power, at the end of the day, he did in fact do it by legal means in a very crafty way. So von Hildebrand, 1914, the war, World War I breaks out, and he was exempted from military service initially because he was a young married man with a child. He and his wife, and this is to be very clear to our listeners, this is his first wife. So he had married in 1912, and he and his wife had one son. They named him Francis, after St. Francis of Assisi, precisely because of that great impact of St. Francis on their conversion. She converted with him, by the way. They converted together. They had... their paths, in some sense, were different. Their own personal life of faith was very different over the years, but they did, in fact, convert at the same time, entered the church. Then he, during the warriors, was able to fulfill his military duties by working as a kind of nurse to a surgeon, not a nurse, a kind of surgeon's assistant to a Red Cross physician. And only at the end of the war, he would have been called up, but then he was diagnosed with chronic appendicitis. So he was spared fighting in the war. But it's interesting because he hated World War I. He hated the very premise of it. He thought that this sort of nationalistic belligerence between nations was terrible. He was in fact a conscientious objector and would have clung to that as long as possible. And only when Germany began to lose the war did he, you know, was that conscientious objection, you know, going to expire on him, so to speak. But then the war comes to an end, and he's appointed as a assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Munich. And he began a teaching career from 1919, that lasted from 1919 until 1933, when Hitler finally came to power as Chancellor of Germany. And it's very significant that he would have been in Munich as opposed to in other parts of Germany, because Munich was very much home base. It was the original territory in which National Socialism really had its roots. So Hildebrand had a kind of set of front row seats, you might say, to the early National Socialist Party. Now, in 1921, there was virtually no, I mean, the Nazi Party was at most a kind of regional phenomenon. It would have looked like a lot of other far-right nationalist parties. They sounded a lot like other parties that had an aggressive nationalist tenor. They tended to be very anti-Semitic. There were a sort of set of common traits, and the nascent Nazi Party would have sounded a lot like them. But it's very significant, though, that von Hildebrand's enmity with the Nazis began not because he became a critic of the party, but really because he opposed, you might say, certain core pillars of the party. So he was at a peace congress in Paris just after the war, and it was a very daring invitation by a French Catholic, Marc Sangier, who was very much a Catholic of the French Catholic left. But nevertheless, they came together on various fronts, Sangier and von Hildebrand, and Sangier invited Hildebrand as a representative of Germany and as a gesture to Germany. In other words, to have at a conference organized by the French, the Germans there was a very daring thing, and it was a very, you might say, tense sort of gathering to bring people together at a time like this. And von Hildebrand was put on the spot. He was basically sort of goaded on by more aggressive attendees of the conference to say something nationalistic, basically to say something in which he would show that he wasn't really serious about peace. And so he was asked to admit that Germany was responsible for World War I. And he said, well, I can't accept this statement or agree with that because I don't know enough the historical sources. But if I was confronted with the evidence that, in fact, that was the case, I would have no hesitation in doing that. So he's managed to get his head out of that noose, you might say. But then a follow-up question comes to him, and someone stands up and says, but at least admit that the German invasion of Belgium at the beginning of World War I was a crime. And the listeners need to know that Belgium was a neutral country under a treaty that it had signed with Germany and other countries, in fact. But without skipping a beat, von Hildebrand said it was an atrocious crime. It was a terrible, brutal invasion. It was known as the Rape of Belgium, in fact, in the years after. And, of course, there was thunderous applause from amongst the various Belgian and French delegates at this conference. The Germans weren't so happy, and in particular, there was a German journalist there who writes an article that appears in what actually later became the Nazi newspaper in Munich, an article that headlined Dietrich von Hildebrand, traitor, blames Germany for the start of World War I, which, of course, he hadn't even said. He, in fact, had sort of abstained from making that final statement. So he arrives back in Germany to what I suppose today we would call a kind of media storm. It was all over the German papers, Dietrich von Hildebrand. And again, one has to also bear in mind that name, the name Hildebrand, particularly in Munich, it would have been like the name Kennedy for us in this country. I mean, this was a big, prominent family, well-known. And here's the scion of that family supposedly saying something traitorous in France.
Tangential interjection, Hitler was quite a fan of Dietrich von Hildebrand's father's artwork, right?
Yeah, I think we have to say that might have been one of the few good qualities that Hitler exhibited.
Von Hildebrand was a name to Hitler, and his father was a positive name to Hitler.
That's exactly right. And so for von Hildebrand, as the son of a man widely treasured by even Hitler himself, to have made these statements abroad was very scandalous. He had to explain himself to his colleagues at the university and even within the various academic groups that he was a part of. But what happened, above all, with respect to our major storyline here, is that it put him on the radar of the rising Nazi Party. his being added to their blacklist as one of their early opponents and someone they wanted to wipe out at the earliest moment that they came to power dates back to that first statement. And the reason I sort of make a lot out of this story, which can seem perhaps a little bit like, well, all right, so he was courageous and he made these kind of statements, but you know, when does the anti-Nazism begin? Well, it begins with this because it shows that he began as an intellectual opponent of what Nazism stood for. You know, he didn't just become an enemy of the party because he had other political allegiances. He recognized that there was something in nationalism as opposed to, and he would later on in his work distinguish very sharply between nationalism and patriotism. And he thought that nationalism was in some sense the very, it looked perhaps at times like patriotism, and certain people thought of themselves as being patriotic, but he thought it was a very, very different thing. And you might say that nationalism can give us World War I, but patriotism could never give you a war, because patriotism is inherently peace-loving. So if we want to do justice to Hildebrand's intellectual opposition and intellectual struggle, it's worth going back to this very, very first statement of his. Now, you might say everything else sort of started to move quickly after that, because this was 1921. Hitler then tried to seize power. I think many of our listeners know this chapter in German history, the so-called Beer Hall Putsch, where he tried to stage a coup in Munich, and they wanted to topple the government in Bavaria, and then they wanted to march on Berlin, and this was how he was going to take power. It ended very badly for Hitler. In fact, the whole thing fell apart that very night, but there were about 24 hours where it was unclear to everyone on the ground what was happening, and so von Hildebrand had to flee for his life because the Nazis had set up a kind of tribunal and were already beginning to wipe out their opponents at the time. So even though this coup came to an end and Hitler was put into jail, von Hildebrand, even in 1923, 10 years before Hitler became chancellor, had his first brush with danger. So to accelerate the storyline here again, Hitler finally comes out of jail actually very soon after. He was only imprisoned for, I think the sentence was 5 years or so, and he only served about 9 months or 10 months. And he came out, and after that experience, that's when he decided, I'm going to seek political leadership in Germany through legal means, because he realized then and there that the risks of failure were too great. And so this is it, from that experience also you see this sort of turn to a crafty strategic rise in Hitler. Mm-hmm. Hitler, by the late 1930s, Hitler has turned this tiny little national socialist movement into a major political force. They're winning in elections. They're winning seats in the German parliament. Hitler's running for president against the.
You said late 30s.
The late 1930s. So there's definitely a period in which Hitler falls off the national stage.
You don't mean late 20s?
I mean the late 20s. I'm sorry. I mean the late 20s. So Hitler sought power for the first time in 1923, just 2 years after Hildebrand had been in Paris at this peace conference I described. Then when Hitler's first coup attempt falls apart, there's a period of apparent peace. Hildebrand even describes feeling a certain relief, a cleansing of the air, when Hitler's movement failed. But it gradually then, throughout the 20s, and particularly in the late 20s, began to gain steam again. And in the late 20s, they're competing very forcefully in the national elections. In other words, the National Socialist Party is in fact, it's, I think by 1931 or 32, has become the largest party in the German parliament.
Now, I'm going to interrupt you there,
please.
We're about halfway through the hour, and we usually take a short break, halfway through, a short musical break, which we'll have in a moment. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Salvationist from the Jews on Radio Maria with me, your host, Roy Shoman, and our guest for today, John Henry Crosby, who was behind the recent publication of a Dietrich von Hildebrand's memoirs about the war years, as well as other aspects of his life, called My Battle Against Hitler. And when we come back from the break, I would like to talk at least a little bit about, an extraordinary theme of von Hildebrand's battle against Hitler, which is almost his philosophy that one cannot compromise with the devil, that one's always called to confront head-on the devil, and any compromise is capitulation. And I think, again, because of what's going on in our country now, that's probably a theme that it would be good to flesh out a little bit. So So with that, let's go to the break, and we'll be back in a few minutes speaking again with John Henry Crosby about Dietrich von Hildebrand's battle against Hitler.
In blue, teach me how to pray. God was once your little boy. Tell me what to say. Did you lift him up sometimes gently on your knee? Did you sing to him the way that my mother does to me? Did you hold his hand at night? Did you ever try telling stories of the world? Oh, when did he cry? Do you really think he cares if I tell him things, little things that happen? And do the angels' wings make a noise? Can he hear me if I speak low? Can he understand me now? You know, lovely lady, tell me, for you know.
Listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We now return to Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shulman.
Hi, this is Roy Shulman. Welcome back to Salvation is from the Jews on Radio Maria. And we've been speaking with my guest for today, John Henry Crosby, about a great Catholic philosopher and hero of the 20th century, Dietrich von Hildebrand. And before the break, we got up to the basically to 1933, when Hitler came to power. And I wanted to kind of start the second half of the show with a little focus on von Hildebrand's stance towards evil, that there is no possibility of compromising with the devil, that compromise itself is capitulation. And so if you bear with me, John Henry, I just want to read a couple of passages from I don't want to say your book, it's almost your book, it was translated and edited by you, really Dietrich von Hildebrand's book,
My Battle Against Hitler. It is Dietrich von Hildebrand's book, no doubt. I lived with it for a decade, but it is his book and should remain that way.
Yeah. But anyway, again, because of what we're living through now in this country with the assault on Christian values and specifically actually on some Catholic institutions by the government, and this kind of ambivalence about just what our stance should be towards it as Catholics, and also the Catholic institutions and the hierarchy's stance to it. So I'm going to read a couple of passages from the section around pages 81 to 83, from the memoirs of Dietrich von Hildebrand to kind of launch us on this path. In general, the directive from German bishops and priests was this: one may participate in everything that does not violate the faith and the commandments of God. In other words, one can join the SA, continue teaching at the school that has conformed itself to National Socialism. One ought not to give up one's position where one can at least prevent what is worst in small things, continue to do good, and so forth. With the bishops and priests adopting this stance, it is hardly surprising that young, naive Catholics, particularly those who were only Catholic out of tradition, should merrily sing the Horst Wessel lead and be filled with enthusiasm for the Führer. I was, of course, horrified by such a friendly and benign attitude towards the Nazi regime, and I expressed my total rejection of National Socialism and my disdain for Hitler in very clear terms. This kind of argumentation means that you give the devil your little finger. It means opening a door for infection by a dreadful heresy. For this reason, at Pentecost 1933, I wrote a letter to close friends in Munich in which I attempted to describe the stance which, to my mind, was the only one possible for Catholics living in Nazi Germany. I called attention to the terrible danger of allowing oneself to be pressed into compromises, and above all, of inwardly adopting a neutral or even friendly stance toward National Socialism. I explained that they were being confronted by the Antichrist, and that if they were forced to live with him, indeed, even to be exposed to his force, it was absolutely necessary to bear the concealed dagger, as it were, of absolute and irreconcilable enmity, ready to make use of it at the first opportunity without thereby risking the consecration camp. I further wrote that it is completely immaterial if the Antichrist refrains from attacking the Church for political reasons. What is decisive is the spirit that animates him, the heresy he represents, the crimes committed at his behest. Any comment, John Henry?
Well, it's interesting that you should have picked these pages, because I had my book open to the very same page when we discussed focusing on this theme. Now, the passages that you've just read, I think, get to the very heart of one of his major concerns, which is this question of, or this concern about compromise. Particularly when you're confronted with evil and it surrounds you, it's a structural presence, in one of his essays later in the book, he describes the risks that happen, right? That you begin in an initial state of outrage, but then that inevitably we tire, and it's hard to retain that kind of stance, and that over time we become increasingly worn down. And then, as he says, it's even possible to begin to become to have a benign or even friendly attitude. No, I think this is this gets to the very essence of his concerns. It allows me also to say one brief thing that our listeners should know, which is that in 1933, von Hildebrand himself was confronted with the decision what to do when Hitler had come to power. In other words, this concern about complicity, particularly the complicity that he felt he would have as a Catholic philosopher if he remained in Germany and remained silent. Now, it's important to note that von Hildebrand was keenly aware of the role of vocation in all of this. He knew that different people had different vocations within the body of Christ, as it were, to resist evil. And some were, in fact, called to stay behind. And he described certain noble souls who stayed and did very significant work. But he felt that as a philosopher and as a Catholic, and certainly his particular vocation, it was necessary to speak publicly against National Socialism. And he knew that he couldn't do that without, in other words, to his point here, he couldn't do it without risking the concentration camp. So his decision to leave was a decision to honor his conscience, to go and speak, and to speak out against Nazism. And I want to emphasize this so much because a lot of the bios of von Hildebrand that even predate my work, and in fact even the way I perhaps in the past described it, you know, it's easy to say he fled the Hitler, you know, or fled Germany after Hitler's rise to power. I mean, he fled in a very limited sense of the term, but in fact he went away. He went into a kind of voluntary exile so that he could in fact do what he felt called to do. So Hildebrand, in any case, felt strongly that his vocation lay in speaking openly. And in 1933, he leaves Germany and he goes to the home of his birth in Florence. And in fact, to the home, the house where he'd been born, which now belonged to his sister. And it's very significant that, you know, he went there and there were a period of about 6 months during which he didn't even know what he would do. He simply knew that I'm supposed to do something. God is calling, God is asking me of this, asking this of me, and God will provide for me and sustain me and protect me. And it was there that the plan to create an anti-Nazi newspaper was hatched, because from Florence, surveying what was happening in throughout Europe, he took note of the young Chancellor of Austria, a certain Engelbert Dollfuss, who had a stated anti-Nazi policy. In fact, he became stronger in his anti-Nazism as Hitler came to power and as the Nazis began to show their true colors. And he was this young chancellor was a very serious Catholic. And so von Hildebrand approached him and said, I want to be an intellectual officer in the battle against National Socialism. Again, highlighting that philosopher's role in resisting evil. And Dollfuss agreed to support him. In fact, gave him the funding to establish this paper. Would never have gotten off the ground had the Austrian government not supported it. And it was in that paper that von Hildebrand ultimately carried out over the next 5 years his assault on National Socialism and speaking truth to power in every single article. He wrote almost 70 articles, and perhaps more, because there's there are numerous articles under pseudonyms, and it's not clear if he wrote them or not, but at least 70 articles. And this work had an enormous impact. It galvanized the resistance. It gave many other like-minded souls an outlet in which to express themselves. And on the other hand, it gave a lot of visibility to what began initially, you might say, as a private act of conscience to leave his home. And his voice and the resistance was so loud that it created serious resistance from the Nazis. In fact, the Nazis in their relations with Germany and its relations with Austria had a great deal of tension ensued from the work of this paper. You know, there were all of these bridge builders at the time in Austria who wanted to find some way of making it work with Nazi Germany, and von Hildebrand and his paper made that very, very difficult. But ultimately, it was
what is that quote that you have in the or he has in that book? Essentially about no one does more damage to the Nazi party than von Hildebrand.
That's right. The German ambassador, the Nazi ambassador in Vienna, wrote back. Actually said to von Hildebrand's brother-in-law, "No one does more damage to National Socialism in Austria than your brother-in-law Dietrich von Hildebrand." So his both through individual statements and by the official response of the Nazi government, this paper had a great impact at the time. But perhaps, and a final observation, I think the most significant thing about it was a kind of a combination of witness simply standing up for truth, particularly truths that were being obscured at the time. But it had one very significant further impact on its readers. And that's wonderfully brought out by one of the students. And in fact, in the opening pages of the book, I have three quotations. And the student describes, I think, better than anyone, the influence that von Hildebrand had through his teaching and through his writing and through his paper. And the student writes, "He immunized and protected us from the philosophical waves that swept across Germany in those days. Whoever understood von Hildebrand was saved. Heidegger's melodies no longer had the power to seduce us." Heidegger was the philosopher who had a great inspiring role in the Nazi party. And so he says, "Heidegger's melodies no longer had the power to seduce us for our..."
Well, I'm sorry about that. We seem to be suffering from some technical glitches, which can be a good sign for the show. But so I will continue on my own until our guest, John Henry, comes back. And I will try to not butcher too much a little story of this Chancellor Dollfuss that John Henry mentioned, who sponsored Dietrich von Hildebrand's anti-Nazi newspaper in Austria, because it's very beautiful to see. I've been a little bit critical between the lines in the show of some of our contemporary politicians who might be working on the wrong side of the battle between Christ and the enemy of humanity. But it's very beautiful to see saintly political figures who are really battling with their heart and soul, and in the case of Dollfuss, with his life on the right side of that equation. And all I remember, Dollfuss was vehemently anti-Nazi as Chancellor of Austria, and he ended up being assassinated by the Nazis, and he was, I believe, shot in his office, and he lay dying, bleeding to death, actually, on the floor, and I think it took him 8 or 10 hours to bleed to death. And his one plaint during that time that he lay on his office floor bleeding out his life was he asked his assassins to allow him to see a priest, to call a priest to hear his confession and grant him absolution. And in their anti-God sadism, they refused. But I think that's a very beautiful story to show that there can be tremendous nobility even in the halls of power. Now, it looks like I may have to continue the show to the end on my own, so I will do my best. I will perhaps read a little bit more from the book, My Battle Against Hitler, by Dietrich von Hildebrand. By the way, you can order this from John Henry's organization, which is the Dietrich von Hildebrand Project, or from Amazon.com or any other major bookseller. But let me just spend a minute or two talking about the other side of the coin, which is it pained Dietrich von Hildebrand deeply. Are you there, John Henry?
I'm here. I'm very
great.
Sorry about that.
I'm sabotaging you because I'm going to take this tack. I've already begun down the path, and I just want to spend a moment or two talking about the pain that Dietrich von Hildebrand suffered at seeing misguidedness coming from the Catholic hierarchy and seeing a lack of clarity about what was going on and kind of getting swept away with the tide of the way of the world. So I'm going to read from pages 86 and 87, and then, give it back to you. Anyway, so here are the words of Dietrich von Hildebrand. But much sadder and incomparably worse than this radical intellectual and cultural decline was the letter of the Catholic bishops gathered in the town of Fulda. Contrary to all tradition, the bishops took a position toward the government. They began by listing all the things within National Socialism to which they spoke a full approving yes. We affirm the spirit of authority. We affirm the commitment to the German nation. We affirm, etc., etc. All this affirmation was a shameful betrayal, quite apart from the fact that the bishops after World War I did not take a similar position towards the Weimar Republic, so that taking an official position in the present context was unnecessary. Terms such as authority, nation, and the like were used equivocally, when it was clear to everyone that what the National Socialists understood by these terms was something the bishops could never affirm. Besides, the fact that the affirmation of many points was very much in the foreground, created by the impression of a primarily affirmative stance toward National Socialism as such. Words cannot describe how this failure of the German episcopacy grieved me. To my sorrow, I saw how right I was to fear that Catholics in Germany would allow themselves to be carried away by a shameful spirit of compromise and accommodation toward the Antichrist. Over to you, John Henry.
Oh my goodness. What is there? What can one say after such powerful words? But no, the stance of the German bishops, particularly from about 1932 into the mid-30s, 33, 34, 35, grieved von Hildebrand profoundly, above all, for two reasons. The one was obviously that there were statements that were shameful and should never have been made. But then beyond that, there was this lack of the ability to discern spirits clearly. And that also grieved him because he saw all of this with such great clarity. But of course, it was the bishops' inability to fulfill their teaching function and their guiding role for the laity that above all grieved him. So these statements were misleading, and they gave Catholics the feeling that all was well with the National Socialism. There were a few points that had to be more or less modified, but basically you could participate in this without any reservations or concerns. And of course, this was ultimately his great concern in July of 1933, when the Catholic Church signed a concordat with Germany. When the Vatican
Let me hold the concordat, because that needs most of a show in itself.
Indeed. Well, there you have my comments. I mean, in any case, it was a source of great grief for him. He thought it was terribly misleading, and of course, this is why he tried to protect his friends by equipping them with that spirit of discernment and clarity, as he had it, so that even without the guidance of the Church, they could take a more adequate stance.
I want to invite our listeners to listen to the last, or to think of the last 3 or 4 minutes of what our guest has said, and think of it in our current context, because we're clearly living in a political environment which is making a frontal assault on God's morality. And we're the same danger of requiring, of needing to really keep a clarity of focus and a willingness to recognize evil as evil and to refuse to compromise with it or water down the teaching is, I would argue, at least as necessary for Catholics in the United States today as it was for Catholics during the rise of Hitler to power, which is why I invited that little tangent. Now, we have come to the last couple of minutes of the show, and you've been very gracious, John Henry, and you haven't turned this into an infomercial, but I invite you to, for a minute or two, tell our listeners how they can pursue their interest in what you've introduced to them in the show.
Well, thank you so much, and I there are many more conversations to be had, Roy, so thank you for having me. Frankly, I would simply say that the most significant thing anyone could do at this time to encounter and learn from the great Dietrich von Hildebrand is to read this new book, My Battle Against Hitler. It contains the memoirs. He wrote a very, very long memoir for his second wife. His first wife had died. His second wife is the much-loved Alice von Hildebrand. He wrote a memoir for her at her request because she had missed so much of his life. And so in somewhat both typical, perhaps, German academic fashion and also typical of his spirit, he wrote 5,000 pages. The book contains, though, just a few hundred pages, and it's the pages that describe the story of his confrontation with National Socialism. And then the second half of it, or the last third, I should say, contains excerpts from the articles that he wrote in his Vienna newspaper. Both are significant for today. The one gives us the story of his life, the firsthand impression of what he underwent in fighting National Socialism. But the essays are particularly significant today. Can you hear me?
Yeah, now. Why don't you also give the website of the Dietrich von Hildebrand Project?
The website of the Hildebrand Project is simply www.hildebrandproject.org.
Hildebrand, of course, being spelled H-I-L-D-E-B-R-A-N-D. And the book can be gotten from your website or from booksellers and so forth?
It can be gotten from our website. We encourage people to get it from lots of different sources because in terms of the ability to demonstrate sales, it's very important to have it come from many different parts. So wherever our listeners get their books, they can get them. Even EWTN carries the book. We are also very active on social media, which has become almost part of our apostolate, because in an era where people don't always read as much as we would like, there's a great opportunity to share von Hildebrand's wisdom there. So on Facebook, we're at facebook.com/Hildebrand Project.
Great. Well, I just want to thank you for coming on. I hope you'll join us again soon, and because we've truncated this, I find, very interesting conversation. So perhaps we can continue it in a week or so, or two. And I'd like to, of course, thank our listeners for listening. You can download, record, re-listen to the show, as all these shows, on either the Radio Maria website, radiomaria.us, or my website, salvationsfromthejews.com. And I invite you to join us again next week on Salvation is from the Jews. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.